If you're listening to The Gist on Spotify right now, and we have some indication that you are, we would appreciate it if you would follow, rate, and share the show with a friend. It takes less than half a minute, but possibly more than 22 seconds, and it helps keep the show healthy. Thank you so much. Now, here is the aforementioned show. It's Thursday, December 12th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The death, the homicide of Jordan Neely, a mentally ill homeless man who threatened others on the New York City subway, is a tragedy. But it is also a tragedy with no good solutions. Mental illness is a very tough societal problem to solve. Homelessness, even more so, especially in New York City. Citizen-induced chokeholds. That is not a solution to this problem. What you'd have to do to solve the problem is go back 50 years or so and totally change the zoning and building laws of the city. And even that would not totally tackle the homelessness or the mental illness problem. To give you a scope of our housing shortage and crisis in New York, just a couple days ago, a massive and ambitious program passed called City of Yes. And it could, if it works out well, add 80,000 new units over 15 years, which is good. It's better than not having 6,000 units a year. Estimates are, however, that the city doesn't need to add 80,000 units over 15 years. It needs to add 560,000 units in the next 5 years just to ameliorate the crisis. It's not going to happen, meaning there is going to be homelessness. But you can't say that. You can't say that if you're a politician. You can't say that to a group of people if you don't want to see downcast and disappointed faces. But there is something you can say. People say it all the time. I know exactly what to say. Here's Al Gore saying it.
We're going to save the future and give people hope. We can do it. And remember that political will is itself a renewable resource.
That was in a different context than homelessness. But here's a mayor of another city, Bill Wells of El Cajon, California, saying it about this problem.
Well, that's a tough question. But the honest answer is we have to have the political will to do it. If we would say that homelessness is not a viable lifestyle choice.
We don't have the political will. It's a fine thing to say. It turns the accusation back on us. It's a way of saying we need to look in the mirror. Or even better, you don't even have to look in the mirror. You just have to say we need to look in the mirror. Another step removed from actual action. When you hear political will, what it usually means is this agenda item is either extremely unpopular or impossible. Sometimes it would be popular if people knew the contours of the solution. Oftentimes, it is simply impossible, and that alone makes it unpopular. Let's talk about homelessness. Homeless in New York City, according to official statistics, on any given night, 350,000 people, over 100,000 in shelters. Of the people who are in Jordan Neely's category, unhoused, sleeping on the streets, sleeping on subways, what they call in Europe and Canada the rough sleepers. There were 4,140 counted in the one-day count that the city does every January. There have been a lot of studies on the effectiveness of supporting housing to help mentally ill homeless people. It's much more effective. It's much cheaper than hospitalization. However, to build a unit of supporting housing in New York City costs $500,000. So to house just those 4,000 people, and of course, once you do, there will be more people who have become mentally ill, more people who prove themselves unable to live in the shelter system, more people who maybe were not mentally ill but became homeless and then developed mental illness, which of course is exacerbated by stress like homelessness. But anyway, if you could build 4,000 units for those rough sleepers, it would cost $2 billion. $2 billion is a lot of money. But New York City has a budget of $109 billion, so it can be done, right? Well, $2 billion is the entire cost of whole city agencies. The entire Department of Sanitation budget citywide is $1.9 billion. So, do you want to house 4,000 individuals at the cost of furloughing every sanitation worker and not picking up trash for a year? The Department of Transportation, they have a budget of, well, their maintenance budget is about $500 million a year. So what you could do is not repair a single road in the city for 4 years if you want to build these units for 4,000 and hope that helps the next Jordan Neely, though it wouldn't help anyone and wouldn't help people who develop these conditions after those 4,000 units are built. Maybe you are hearing this, say, I don't care, do it. And it's just so horrible, the homelessness, what the situation Jordan Neely was in. But in doing so, you are probably not thinking of the consequences in lives of crumbling or unsafe streets or of filth and lack of sanitation. So this is what I would call in the category of impossible. And if somehow you rammed it through, it would be extremely unpopular. It is quite popular to say we are all at fault. It is popular to say we don't have the political will. That I know to be a very effective thing to say. But as a thing to do, it's much harder, to the point of admitting we're currently incapable of doing it. On the show today, how great would an American system of universal health care be? But remember, it would be an American system. But first, yesterday on the show, I spoke with the Washington Post, Shadi Hamid, about Israel's treatment of the innocents in the war on Hamas. Today, we're picking up that conversation where we left off. Talk about fighting tactics and morality. Shadi Hamid up next. We're joined once more by Shadi Hamid, who is a columnist for the Washington Post and the author most recently of The Problem with Democracy. I listened to him on the Wisdom of Crowds podcast. And in the last episode, Shadi said that Israel has a revenge-based policy. I want to take a little bit of issue with that and pick it apart a little bit. I would say that most leaders within Israel would say, and not just out of self-justification, that their main policy was not based on revenge, but was based on degrading Hamas and extracting hostages. So my question for you, Shadi, is do you agree with that? Do you think that Israel successfully attacking, killing Hamas, destroying tunnels, doing all that it did, which perhaps also did include war crimes or even crimes against humanity, and I am open to the proof on that charge, do you think that those efforts, those brutal military efforts, did lead to the first deal wherein dozens of hostages were released by Hamas?
Yes, certainly there have been serious strategic gains in terms of degrading Hamas's abilities militarily. There's no doubt about that. But I think that the military assessments were that Hamas had already been degraded months ago, or like more, 6 months ago, let's say, and that different U.S. assessments have made various claims depending on what you're looking at. And the question is, why does this keep on going on with no end in sight, no willingness to agree to a ceasefire? And of course, Hamas also hasn't been willing to enter into a ceasefire, and both parties have had reservations and they have their own interests in keeping up the fight indefinitely. But I think the issue here is that we have senior Israeli officials who have said that they want to have a siege on Gaza and not let humanitarian aid in. And this has been explicit. And so there has been this idea of collective punishment, that if you basically say to civilians in Gaza, we're not going to let anything in, the idea then is that they would turn against Hamas. Again, there's a logic there, but collective punishment of that nature is a war crime. A siege where you actually bring about the prospect of starvation is a war crime. If you're actively not allowing trucks to get in, and that's been our own internal assessment from the Department of State and USAID, that Israel has deliberately impeded the flow of humanitarian aid, that is a war crime. And again, those are our own internal assessments as the U.S. government. So I think the fact that you have Israeli officials who have talked in such brutal language and not made careful distinctions between combatants and non-combatants in the first couple of weeks after October 7th, Israeli President Isaac Herzog said this explicitly, that the whole nation is responsible. His argument basically was that because Palestinians had voted for Hamas in 2006, when the majority of Palestinians weren't even of voting age, that because of that, somehow they were all implicated. Again, the language of collective punishment. I don't think that we as Americans should indulge in the language of collective punishment.
Some of what you're saying I agree with, some I don't. I don't know how much it's worth getting into. I would say that I know Gallant has been quoted as saying that there will be no Hamas, we will eliminate it all. But his entire quote, I think, shows that he was not vowing a siege. And for however many ministers that you could point to, especially the more radical ones in the administration who did speak of siege, there were hundreds of comments saying this is not our intention. This is just... there's a question for you. Is the idea that it doesn't matter if, say, the Israelis talk about not wanting to punish all the citizens of Gaza and having both sympathy and trying to protect citizens of Gaza, does it matter if you could point to many instances where they say that and many instances where they actually do that? What really does matter is the instances where they don't, because that's like a criminal admitting to the crime. Or if you watch The Jinx, he admits to it at the end. It doesn't matter how many times that he denies it beforehand.
Yeah, look, I mean, first of all, Israel doesn't really talk all that much. Certainly the military spokespeople don't talk a lot about prioritizing, protecting civilians. That's not really the language they use. Yes, are there instances where they have said things like that? Sure, but then there's the other...
Well, they always... there's this massive campaign to notify civilians when strikes are coming, and it doesn't always work perfectly, but they try to tell civilians to
With all due respect, if you're just going to blow someone's home and you're going to give them like 30 minutes advance notice and be like, hey, sorry, guys, find something to do, but you don't actually give them a safe zone to go to, and then later on, weeks later, that safe zone gets bombed by airstrikes... Basically, people have nowhere to go. And this is not a new thing that I'm saying. I mean, this has been well documented, this has been the concern of the Biden administration. When they leak things of Biden's frustrations with Israel, it often has to do with the fact that safe zones aren't actually protected. It's worth noting that as early as December, so just 2 months after October 7th, Biden said on the record that Israel's bombardment of Gaza was, quote unquote, over the top. He's also said that Israel's bombings were indiscriminate. So when our own president, who's very sympathetic to Israel and is very understanding and has been very reticent to suspend or withdraw any military support to Israel, when even he's saying that Israel is engaging in an over-the-top, indiscriminate bombing campaign, you know, I just think that at some level we have to say, yes, it is over-the-top and indiscriminate. And look,
but this
I guess
has not been his consistent message. He walked back the indiscriminate remark. We know that Biden says a lot of things that are walked back, and he also says things like, I'll never pardon Hunter, and then he does. So to me, that's very much like Gallant or other ministers here or there saying something that can be interpreted or misinterpreted as an actual violation of war crimes, but the vast majority of what they say and do aren't that. Why is it that? Is it that the admission carries so much more weight than the denial?
So, I'm not sure I really am on board with the argument that just because most of what you do isn't war crimes. I mean, this has been a very long war. So even if you were willing to make the argument that a lot of what Israel does doesn't meet the threshold of a war crime, that's not really the rubric that we use. I mean, the rubric that we use is, were there war crimes? Whether it's a certain percentage or not of the overall operations, I mean, not sure how you would really calculate that. But my basic argument, which is one I think that's supported by, I mean, you know, not to say everyone, but, you know, the vast majority of human rights organizations and international organizations, I know people see them as biased, is that Israel has committed war crimes. And I think that for those specific criminal acts, even if they're not everything Israel is doing, we should be able to say, well, we're not comfortable with that. On the question of genocide, and you'll note that I haven't used the word genocide here, I don't think it's particularly helpful to use such a loaded word, because I think then we get into the legal definitions of what constitutes a genocide, and that's not always the most helpful debate. But I think war crimes and, and I think I think it's not even really a question of war crimes as much as, is this the way we think war should be conducted? Mm-hmm. Gaza, Gaza is obliterated. There's really no stone, not much of Gaza that has been left untouched. And there's nowhere for Gazans to go. And the pictures and images that the world has seen have been very clear in that regard. And again, you can say, well, oh, there are tunnels underneath, so it's justified. But in the end, is that how we understand war? That if there is a mid-level commander, if there happens to be a tunnel underneath, that you can just like level the entire apartment block and say, well, sorry, civilians, there's this Hamas guy underneath you. Sorry, we got to do that. Israel has agency. So I don't think we should always be saying, but Hamas did this. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel is not a terrorist organization. It is a state. And because it is an ally, we should hold it to a higher standard. Because it is a democracy, we should hold it to a higher standard. Because we as Americans believe in a moral way, at least we try to be more moral when we're in a war. Whether or not we always live up to that is a different consideration. But at least there's an aspiration to being better. We're not like Russia when it comes to leveling cities or attacking hospitals or targeting schools. And I think that if we're using that same rubric when it comes to our enemies like Russia, we should be consistent and apply that to our friends. And sometimes that's what friends need. They need tough love. I've never argued that we should just cut Israel off and say, you're no longer an ally. We're not going to have any kind of business with you. That's not realistic. Even if that's what I would want in some ideal world, that's never going to happen. My argument has always been much more simple and one that I think is quite mainstream in the Democratic Party, which is, if we're giving you tens of billions of dollars of military assistance in the form of advanced weaponry, logistics support, munitions, tanks, you name it, let's expect something in return, that you meet at least a basic threshold of humanitarian concern and attention. You don't have to take our weapons, but if you do, I think it's not unreasonable to expect a certain standard and a certain level of assessment in the stuff that we give one of our partners.
Do you think that Hamas's tactics, which were meant to draw Israel into a fight and probably meant to draw Israel into this fight, in any way explains, if not excuses, much of what you just laid out, the bombings of hospitals and the killings of many civilians?
Yeah, so look, there's no doubt that Hamas intermingles itself within civilian infrastructure. I mean, most militant groups do that. It's not something that's necessarily unique to Hamas. But how are...
They do it very extensively, right? Fallujah had some of that, but one of the reasons why the U.S. was able to separate the fighters from the civilians is that there wasn't that deep integration,
yes,
that decades-long integration.
Yes, yeah. I agree with that. Hamas does it more than other militant groups have. Also, I mean, I think that the terrain of Iraq is a little bit different in that regard. But yes, I take your point. But just because Hamas does something, I don't see how that means that Palestinian civilians, the vast majority of whom are not part of Hamas, should pay the price. This is where we get into, again, the issue of collective punishment. Just because there is a militant or terrorist group in your midst and they're doing very bad things, does that relieve Israel of its moral responsibility to conduct war in a better, more proportional, more targeted manner? I think what Israelis often say is like, look, we didn't have a choice, but you always have a choice. The idea that a military doesn't have a choice, that they've been forced into it, that language makes me very nervous, because it means that the people who are pressing the button when they're dropping bombs, did they not have a choice? We always retain our choice.
And what's the limiting factor? Once you tell yourself you have no choice, then where do you stop?
Yeah.
How is the line ever drawn? But I do think that the Hamas strategy was to take the citizens of Gaza and human shields is maybe a cliche, but make sure that Israel had to go through the bodies of those citizens in order to get to the Hamas fighters. And there's, you know, a history of armies embedding themselves with civilians, the Confederacy and the Civil War. But if the United States were fighting the Nazis and the Nazis' tactic were to grab German citizens and put them in between American bullets and Nazi soldiers, I don't think that the United States would have made very different choices. This was, maybe it's a tough choice, but this was the specific choice that Hamas is very much thrusting in front of Israel. I don't know how many, yeah, it's true, the United States has different laws of proportionality. They also fight wars that are thousands of miles overseas, that if they lose will be a little bit of a knock on prestige and the warrior class will feel it, but most Americans won't. So when you add all that up, this is not to excuse Israel. And like I said, I'm open to the idea, especially if investigations reveal that there were war crimes. You think about 2,000 pound bombs in urban settings. That seems unjustifiable. Those kind of bombs were even withheld by the Biden administration. But add up the totality of what Hamas wanted to do and the real perception of existential threat. I don't know that the good countries would have fought the war in a different way, the United States included. Especially, sorry, I'm throwing a lot here, especially since, you know, the United States killed more civilians in Afghanistan than Israel's killed in Gaza.
So, okay, couple things here. Yes, you're right that Hamas officials have said that they want to basically provoke Israel into killing a lot of their own civilians. And Israel appears to have met their expectations in that regard. It should kind of give us pause that the very things that Hamas said it wanted to provoke Israel into doing, Israel is doing. We know this about terrorist groups. This was the same idea with 9/11. A terrorist group, because of its relative weakness vis-a-vis the major power that it's trying to fight, it tries to provoke the greater power into overreaction. And we did that post 9/11. We overreacted. I'll just say one thing about the level of brutality that we did or did not use in the Iraq war. And I've gone through the numbers quite carefully on this, and it's on the Iraq body count website, which is one of the main sources for the civilian toll in the Iraq war. The number of Iraqi civilians who were directly killed by the U.S. military from 2003 to 2011 was 14,000. Which is already quite a bit less than what Israel was able to do in about 6 months. And also Iraq had about 20 times the population of Gaza. So just like on any measurable level, what we did in Iraq just simply doesn't compare to what Israel is doing in Gaza. I would just keep that in mind. That's why.
Yeah, but if you look at Afghanistan, those numbers are higher. And I don't know, direct or indirect, but it could be
100,000
people killed.
But the war in Afghanistan was also 20 years long. So you also have to look at the duration that was involved here. But yes, but at the same time, like if the idea is that we're saying that any other Western power would do something similar, I hear what you're saying. But if that is actually the case, then that should give us pause about the supposed morality of Western powers, just because it's the kind of thing that we could imagine doing in similar circumstances, doesn't make it justified. It might make it understandable, and that's what we were talking about at the beginning. Understandable for me is not the same as justifiable.
Yeah. I want to go back to you, and I want my listeners to know, you lead with realism when friends of yours or people in your circles were saying, Shadi, come out to a march to demand a ceasefire. You said, well, first of all, I'm a journalist. Second of all, like, what are the terms of the ceasefire? Is it realistic? You know, the sort of things that activists don't often ask, but good journalists and experts do. So I know you always think about realism. With that in mind, you just said the United States should not abandon Israel as an ally. Would you like to see the United States, I guess, first joining the ICC and arresting Netanyahu and Golan should they step on U.S. soil?
Look, what I might want in an ideal world, I mean, the
like, would you advise, okay, you're in the administration and some president who would hire you is in office. Would you advise that?
Yes, I would, because I don't think that folks like Netanyahu or Golan should be able I don't think we should be inviting them to come to the White House and spending time in the U.S. And even if we don't agree with the ICC's, again, a determination of genocide or not genocide, just the fact that these folks have been accused of war crimes, and in my view, those accusations are warranted. So my view is that people who commit war crimes should not be invited to come to the White House and get that kind of diplomatic treatment. At the very least, until there's an investigation, until we can assess with some clarity what crimes were committed and what weren't. And so that's kind of where I stand on that. But because, as you said, I'm a realist, I haven't even really thought of that, because it's really just absurd to think that we would ever do that to Netanyahu and say, hey, man, you can't come. And if you do, I mean, also debates around whether the ICC, we're not a party to the ICC. So there's also that fact that the U.S. has generally not been on board with the international law regime that the ICC is part of. So legally speaking, I'm not sure how that would even work. But what we dream about and what we might want in an ideal world is not the same as what we realistically do. And that's why I always try to make that distinction. And I don't want to ask for too much. Like, I don't want to go to the Biden administration or in my writing and ask them to do something I know they're never going to even consider doing. I want my asks to be more modest and more realistic, and some that even folks like you. So we're not on the same page on Israel-Palestine. We see it fundamentally differently, but maybe through persuasion, I could get you on board to maybe say, well, maybe we should suspend some arms shipments to Israel until they show that they're getting humanitarian aid to Israel in this particular way. That's a more reasonable thing that I think maybe you and I could agree on. We could have a discussion about that. And that, to me, is the more useful way of arguing about these things. Once we get into genocide, the ICC, I'm probably going to lose you, and I don't want to lose you.
No, you're right. And I probably would get on board with something like, if you had laid out a realistic way for the United States to pressure Israel in forming a commission internally, a bona fide commission, maybe even with some United States experts on it, on war crimes in that country. Actually, it probably would have been in Israel's interest as well. I wanted to ask you about a major theme of your podcast and your writing, which is withholding your vote or the...
the fade. I hit you with the fade. People hate the fade. But by now, you might know what it means. It means there's more of this conversation. And listen, we didn't stint on the Shadi Hamid, but there was still a lot more interesting stuff, especially about how an impassioned pro-Palestinian advocate might play the strategy of who to vote for in the election. This is something that Hamid was writing about and talking about a lot. So I talked to him about it. We talked about domestic politics and much more. To listen to even more of this interview and all of our Pesca Plus offerings, to listen to the show without ads, there's a price tier for that too. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. For a limited holiday time only, use the promo code CHEESE at checkout for 20% off your ad-free podcast, 20% off your Pesca Plus podcast. Or if you want to give a gift to someone, the 20% off is automatically included. That is a limited time only, and that is at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. I've been thinking about the motives of the shooter, of the former president of United Healthcare, Luigi Mangione. Somehow we're allowed to say his name all the time, even though the normal rule of thumb is to not valorize shooters and assassins and mass shooters by giving them notoriety. Well, so much has changed the rules around decorum
when it comes to this shooting, and I guess because it has tapped into a national anger, which I've talked about in the past. To me, it's an obvious anger, and though I guess an understandable anger, it's not a particularly intelligently directed anger. I kind of resent having to think about or being made to think about the flaws of U.S. healthcare at the point of a gun. So I did read the manifesto, and some facts are wrong, although not hugely wrong. He wrote that United Healthcare is the fourth biggest company in America behind Apple, Google, and Walmart. It's somewhere around 14th. But, you know, its profit margin is pretty small. It's about 6%, unlike the tech giants. But the executives of that company, which does deny a lot of claims as part of its business model, the executives do make a lot of money, and it's easy to see why someone would see them as villains. But remember, in life, there are never solutions, there are only trade-offs. And that's what I think about when I think about healthcare. Yeah, I'd rather have a system like the Canadians or the UK, or maybe even better, a hybrid system like the Germans. But we'd lose out on a lot of things. It takes a long time to schedule even necessary surgeries in advanced first world countries, which have, quote, universal healthcare, universal with long waiting times. There are so many stories of border states with Canada where the Canadians come in for surgeries because they could get their surgeries with good American doctors. The way times and the funding of the NHS in the UK, if you don't follow UK politics, it's always the number one or two issue roiling that country if there's not a Boris Johnson-esque scandal brewing. So perhaps you heard that the United States spends more on out-of-pocket health care than any country in the world, $12,000 a person, almost $13,000 in 2022. That's true. But you know, the United States spends more on almost everything than any country in the world because the United States has more money. When you have more money, you're going to be charged more money. As Noah Smith points out, he's a really good economics writer, Americans are paying a smaller percentage of their healthcare costs out of pocket than people in most other rich countries. The United States spends more on education with worse results, and almost all of education is public. You know, there's an appreciable private education sector, just like there would be under most systems of healthcare if we went to a universal system. The United States spends an ungodly amount on transportation. It costs two or three times per mile of track what it does in a place like France. And are, especially when it comes to railroad transportation, is not nearly up to snuff. And the money is not mostly going to administrative costs. It's not mostly going to middlemen. It's going to your healthcare providers, who you might like, or hospitals, who you might not. But, you know, becoming a doctor in the United States is very expensive, and it takes longer than in most other peer countries. It takes longer to be a doctor in the U.S. than it does in the U.K., longer than it does in France, and our doctors go into deep debt to do so. I've been thinking about other systems in the United States that aren't privatized, that fall under the rubric of the universal, like universal healthcare would if we had it. What about the roads? The roads aren't privately built. I mean, you can find the privately built road in a gated community. But recently, I heard a podcast with Wes Marshall, and it got me to thinking because he's an expert in the subject. And I was also thinking about when someone gets killed by a drunk driver, it's usually blamed on the drunk driver. But, you know, the construction of the roads is, if you're drunk, it's more likely to kill someone in our country than other countries. There are some statistics that show. So I was listening to Wes Marshall, and it is the case that no one specifically is getting rich off the roads or road construction, meaning there is no middle. There are people, of course, who do this for a living, but there's no middleman adding administrative costs. There's no one denying a needed road. You don't hear statements like, we're the only developed country with private roads. But is the situation with traffic good in America? It's a public good, but is it good? Here was Wes Marshall.
To be honest, like that phrase, like safety is our first priority, it's a lie. It's not true. Like in the book, I sort of go through, you know, how we're so much more focused on things like traffic congestion, mobility, especially mobility of cars, and, you know, things like safety end up being third or fourth. So I joke safety third is really more apt. And when you look at our transportation system. You go to any of like the big intersections where we know people are routinely dying on the roads. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to like know, you know, to have done what I've done to just feel that this place is unsafe. So, you know, safety first is a nice mantra. But it's just not true. So, I mean, that's kind of big picture.
Now, the name of the book, once again, is Killed by a Traffic Engineer, Shattering the Delusion that Science Underlies Our Transportation System. Our transportation system, other transportation systems are better than ours. There are a lot of systems in the United States where other countries' systems, nationalized systems, are better than ours. Because the United States will always be a capitalist country. Profits will be squeezed and chased and prioritized and bundled up and sold as stocks. But if we had a universal system in America, it would still be an American system, which is to say subject to large inequities. In the United States, safety is very unequal. The cops serve everyone. Pollution is unequal. The EPA serves all. Healthcare would be unequal. There are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. What I hate most about our healthcare system is actually the forms and the bureaucracy and the filling out of forms and the fact that they're looking to deny your forms. God, do I hate that. I would pay a lot in taxes not to have to do that. But if it were nationalized, there would still be bureaucrats to get in the way of your health care. Their job wouldn't be to deny claims to make someone money, but there'd certainly be bureaucrats whose job it was to deny or delay services because they couldn't get services to everyone if it were taxpayer funded. For instance, this is a pretty obvious example, but I hate going to the post office. I get super frustrated at the post office. The job of the people who work at the post office is not to deny me mail services to make anyone rich. They just can't get to everyone. They don't get to everyone with the speed of a UPS or a FedEx. 9 times out of 10, I'll use a UPS or my local package store in favor of the post office, which is slow and inconvenient and hard to get to, and oftentimes filled with people who aren't very nice to you. Yeah, I know the current Postmaster General is essentially trying to destroy the post office, but guess what? I think he's doing a pretty good job. And what's to say under a universal system that some politician, some president wouldn't appoint someone to run the system who wants to destroy the system? That seems to be the trend with all government systems. The one real trade-off where it seems to be that there would be a recognized solution is that no one would get rich, which means there would be no symbols of greed to fixate upon and none to shoot. Perhaps certain people would be symbols of inefficiency, and we rail against the system as inefficient in public life, but maybe there wouldn't be that one person for a deranged individual to take a shot at. There'd be rage, but I think it would be less acute and more simmering and dispersed. Is that better? I don't know. That kind of rage is shared by all and becomes a societal ennui when we have a shooter like the, I guess we're mentioning him, Luigi Mangione. He channels some of our rage, some of our not particularly well-informed rage. And I do think under a universal system, we'd have experts like Wes Marshall to write books about the healthcare profession that would blow the whistle on terrible inefficiencies and terrible inequities. There wouldn't be as many readily identifiable villains, but there'd be plenty to get upset about. And knowing America, someone somewhere with a gun would probably find a federal bureaucrat to hate, and then the deranged person would target said bureaucrat. And like the status of our country today, none of that would be healthy either. That's it for today's show. Corey Wara and Joel Patterson are the Quaint Mallards. They're the producer and senior producer of The Gist. Leo Baumes, our intern. Michelle Pesca, CBSO of Peachfish Productions. I want to thank Ryan Dabieri for suggesting Wes Marshall's books and many of the themes of the spiel. Umperu, Jeeperu, Dooperu, and thanks for listening.